Today, we're talking to people who communicate their passion about food in particularly interesting ways. Food as Muse. This is Florida Matters.
Support for Florida Matters comes from the Hospitals of BayCare Health System, providing more than 100 health seminars, classes, and events each month. BayCare's mission is to build a healthier Tampa Bay. Register for a complimentary health seminar, class, or event at baycareevents.org.
From WUSF Public Media, I'm Robin Sussingham. Sometimes when something is as universal, as necessary, and mundane as eating, it's hard to make food sound special, but not for the people on today's Florida Matters. First up, cookbooks are the perfect intersection of food meeting the muse. They can be both inspirational and useful, making them exceptionally good gifts, according to Tampa Bay Times cookbook reviewer Ileana Morales Valentine. WUSF's Bobby O'Brien visited the kitchen of the 28-year-old writer and columnist recently as she was testing a recipe.
So we are going to make some peanut sesame blondies with chocolate chunks. This is from My Two Souths. I'm looking into doing a joint review of two cookbooks, that one and Big Food, Big Love. They're both about Southern food, but from different perspectives. So this one where the blondie recipe is from, it's India meets the South. And the other one is Southern food from a restaurant in Seattle.
How do we get started?
We are going to turn on the oven, 350. And I need to melt some butter, and we're going to toast some sesame seeds and chop some peanuts. It looks like half are going in the batter and then half on top.
Do you come from a lot of cooking in your family background?
Well, I will say that I've been a lifelong enthusiastic eater. I did not cook growing up. My mother, godmother, grandmother, everyone, they show their love through cooking, definitely. I'm from Miami, big family. My mom had her go-tos. My family's Nicaraguan, so she would make gallo pinto and things like that that were traditional, but she never really taught me how to cook.
Do you have her recipe from that?
No, because she refuses to give me a recipe. She insists that I have to like be next to her and just watch what she's doing, which I need to do one of these days, but mostly I just eat it. Okay, so we are going to toast just a tablespoon of sesame seeds. You don't really need oil, just about medium low.
When you review a cookbook, how many of those recipes do you test?
Probably 1 to 3, and that gives you a good sense of the recipe writing and whether they are clear instructors. Like, I recently finished up a review for Dory's Cookies by Dory Greenspan. And she is an excellent recipe writer. Like, you were making a cookie and she'll tell you to pulse the dough in the food processor, but she'll let you know not to go too far so that it starts forming a ball, which is just such a clear visual for what to expect and what not to. You know, cookbooks, of course, are about the recipes, but they're about a lot more than that.
That looks like Irish butter.
It is. It's just the Kerrygold's Irish butter. You can smell it. It smells really good. I think of cookbooks as a form of traveling, really. And when I go on a trip, I kind of travel to eat. I'm always scooping out where I want to go try, you know, in the morning for a bakery or go to a cool restaurant. So with cookbooks, I kind of get access to places that maybe I can't travel to right now. So I cook, my husband does most of the dishes, which I'm very grateful for, but sometimes I can't find where things are. Okay, so we need 1 cup of light brown sugar, and that is going to beat in here with the melted butter. And then we're going to crack in a couple eggs, one at a time. See how it's lighter in color too?
Definitely. That's that egg white starting to fluff up.
Mm-hmm. Stop that for a second. Though I am tempted to always double the vanilla extract. There's one cookbook, Huckleberry, and one thing she said is that there's usually never enough vanilla or salt in baked goods, so she always just doubles whatever the amount of vanilla is called for in a recipe. The less sexy ingredients now, flour, baking powder. What makes a good cookbook for me is it needs to have a point of view. Versus looking up something online, which you can get a recipe for anything you want online, but I like that a cookbook gives me context, and it's someone who's more of an authority and more of a trusted source when I set out to try their recipe in the kitchen. Okay, so now that we've got all our dry ingredients, the flour, baking powder, salts, we're just going to mix that up for a couple minutes. flavor, of course, is king, and trying to interpret that and give the reader a sense of the perspective in the cookbook and the kind of recipes that are in it. So we have an 8x8 cake or brownie pan, and we are just going to butter it. So you see how thick this is, right? And her instructions definitely say spread the batter. Now the rest of our chocolate, sesame seeds, and peanuts are going to go on top. We're going to pop this in. So Small Victories is one of my favorite cookbooks by Julia Tertian, and it is all about small victories for the home cook.
I see a lot of these tabs that you've marked your go-to recipes.
That's kind of the most fun thing, sitting down with a new cookbook and marking everything that you think you want to make first. Another one here. So we have a couple. These are interesting too. So this is all about Korean food. I think I want to do a combo review of this sometime with Korean Food Made Simple and Cook Korean, which is really fun. It's a comic book.
Wow.
Right. And I haven't seen too many of these, but Dirt Candy, that's a restaurant in New York with focused on vegetables. She did a comic book recipe a few years ago, so I've seen maybe a couple of these since, but they're really, really fun. Let me check on the brownies. They look pretty done to me. Oh, it's really pretty. The look of the sesame seeds is really cool.
I'll bet you that really helps with that taste.
They're really good. They're definitely a cakier brownie, too.
Oh, really? Okay.
Mm-hmm. Mmm, I love the sesame.
It's really good.
Mmm, okay.
You can find Ileana Morales Valentine's gift recommendations for cookbooks and cooking utensils, along with her recipe for peanut blondies with toasted sesame seeds and chocolate chunks at WUSFnews.org. For Chef Mike Webb, every meal can be a work of art. But instead of paintbrushes and easels, his tools of the trade are sharp knives and cast iron skillets. Webb was born and raised in Dunedin and trained at the California Culinary Academy in San Francisco. He worked for a number of celebrity chefs, including Wolfgang Puck, before coming home to Tampa Bay. These days, Chef Mike owns a catering company, gives food demonstrations, and cooks at Flanagan's Irish Pub in downtown Dunedin. WUSF's Kathy Carter recently joined him in his noisy kitchen to talk about his inspirations.
Chef Mike, when we talk about muses, what comes to mind most often is an artist, and perhaps he is inspired by a model. For chefs, it might be something different, and for you, it seems to be connection. What do you mean by that?
I believe it comes from the connection with the source of where the food actually comes from. Having a personal relationship with knowing where your food comes from. For example, having a personal relationship with the farmer that's in Brooksville.
So, Chef Mike, when we talk about fresh seasonal ingredients, you have one here that you really enjoy that I'm not aware of. So what are we working with?
Today we have some basically seaside foraged purslane. Purslane is a native Florida succulent. A lot of people find it in their yards and think it's a weed, but it is actually completely edible. A lot of the flavor and consistency of the plant derives from where it was grown. So, for example, the one that I have here comes from the sea. So it's going to pick up a lot of the qualities and characteristics that saltwater has, such as the briny flavor that oysters have in them. It's not salty in any way, but it's fresh like the ocean.
What are some of the things that you would serve personally with?
I've served it char-grilled before as a accompaniment to a blue crab salad and just kind of used it as a bed, as a green. It holds up very well. It's pretty hearty. You can saute it, you can grill it, you can flash fry it.
So you're a native Floridian. When we talk about flavors, the purslane is one of them. What kind of food did you enjoy when you were growing up? Because when we talk about connection, we might also think about memories. And food is so important in our memories.
Yes, it is. Another part of my inspiration is making people happy with my food. And a lot of that stems from drawing memories from your childhood or your past where you were doing something that was very memorable and made you happy and maybe it involved a meal. So a lot of my food style of cooking is comfort food, using local fresh ingredients that are simple, and you're just letting the product speak for itself and what where it came from and how it was cared for.
Well, because our limbic system, our memories are tied to smells, that is why some foods bring back that moment of maybe your mom made you chicken soup when you were sick, and that's why you're drawn to chicken soup. And that in that instant of you serving up a bowl of that hot chicken soup, it's tied back to that memory of your mom taking care of you.
Right, absolutely. So I just want to rehash those feelings for people, and if I get them to make them smile at the end of their meal, then that's what makes me happy and drives me to another day.
As we talked about before, you're a native Floridian, so you're drawn to some of the things that you can get right across the street or up the road in Brooksville. Why is it important to you to use these types of ingredients that are close by or to have a relationship with them?
I believe that as a society, we have gone so far in the opposite direction of what our forefathers and our grandmothers and grandfathers were raised and knew how to do and how they survived. It all stems from having a garden in your backyard and being able to go to your neighbor's house and borrow milk and you can give them eggs. And as a society, we've gotten so industrialized and so far away from that where we're shipping things hundreds of miles across the country one way or the other, and it's counterproductive because we have the technology now and the ability to grow all those things right next door to us, and we're missing that ability to build a community again. And so that's my tie to knowing where your food comes from, because if you can put a table together of food that you know every person that worked really hard to put that food on the table, it's so much more appreciated. And that experience alone, if you have people that all of them, such as a communal table, brought together that contributed to that meal, it just makes it that much more special.
That was Chef Mike Webb of Flanagan's Irish Pub in Dunedin. This is Florida Matters, and we're talking with people who draw their inspiration from food. Coming up.
And you scaled and filleted my keeper on the dock, packed the pink flesh and ice for the ride home, and I cooked it with lemon, butter, and wine, and with our fingers we fed the perfect flaky morsels to each other's mouths.
I'm Robin Sussingham. We'll be right back. I'm Robin Sussingham, and this is Florida Matters. Elisa Albo is a poet and an English professor at Broward College in Fort Lauderdale. Elisa was born in Havana, and her family fled Cuba after Castro took power. They came to the United States and ended up in Lakeland when Elisa was in first grade. She and I were classmates, so I've known her for a long time. Her book of poems, Passage to America, is largely about her family's immigrant experience, but she also writes often and vividly about food, including in this poem, Why It's Delicious.
So the poem, Why It's Delicious, is made of four different stanzas that answer that question, why something is delicious. Because I realized the impulse for writing it was that I realized that the things that we pick or make or harvest, the things that we get ourselves that are fresh that way, taste better. And for example, I went on this trip when I was 16 with a friend to her mother's farmhouse in Pennsylvania, and we picked peas and shucked those, and we picked strawberries and made jam, and those things just tasted better than if you had bought them. And that was the impetus for this poem. So the first stanza has to do with my grandmother, who was an amazing cook and who could just make, you know, wonderful dishes out of anything. And she also had a green thumb, even though she never really lived in the country or anything. And she would just go out into our backyard and throw down some seeds. She didn't plant them. She just threw them down, and they would grow. And so, of course, those things were delicious. So each stanza begins with because, answering that question, why it's delicious. Because my grandmother marched out to the end of the yard, threw the white oval seeds on the ground and walked away. And almost overnight, the tangle of vines wrapped itself around the clothesline pole, the fence, and screened-in porch. Then small green pumpkins sprouted and brightened in places so odd we had to move them to give them room to grow or to keep them from breaking through the screen. And when they were large and heavy, Mima ambled out, lifted the pumpkins, and carried them in to carve and cook the chunks for days in soups with rice and with lemon. And except for a handful, she toasted the seeds, and we ate pepitas with salt, cracking shells with our teeth to reach the slim green meat inside. Because Jeannie's mom planted and tended a garden that grew green peas we shucked on her new husband's farmhouse porch at the foot of a Pennsylvania mountain, and she steamed them and served them for dinner with chicken and mashed potatoes. Because that bicentennial summer Jeannie and I joined her mom, she arranged a net over blueberry bushes under which, clever birds, we snuck to steal the dark ripe beads. Because Jeannie's mom took us to pick fat strawberries we boiled and stirred into jam in huge pots all day, slathered on thick slices of airy Amish bread, carried home in mason jars sealed with paraffin, souvenirs. Because the fleshy grapefruit in the neighbor's yard overhangs our fence and personally announces the coming of winter in our central Florida town, is sweeter and juicier than store-bought fruit I would never pay for, and reminds me of the time we lined smudge pots up and down the rows of groves to keep the freeze from killing the crop, and of how I welcomed my first kiss one evening in the crook of the arm of one of those fragrant trees. Because the moon was full and teasing the tide with her shimmer, when I caught a striped schoolmaster at midnight, even though the fish weren't biting on our side of the party boat, and you scaled and filleted my keeper on the dock, packed the pink flesh and ice for the ride home, and I cooked it with lemon, butter, and wine, and with our fingers we fed the perfect flaky morsels to each other's mouths. I love food, and I love writing about it. It's just very imagistic, and you know, with poetry, you're trying to bring images to life, and with food, you're just trying to have people experience what you're experiencing. And it's, you know, it's part of, food is such a big part of culture and family and traditions. And so, actually, I've been writing food poems for a long time, so I really enjoy doing that. And you can tell stories through food also.
Lisa Albo, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Tampa-based Crail Funch is a home and event stylist. She's the author of the book An Appealing Plan, A Year of Everyday Celebrations, and she also has a blog called An Appealing Plan. She tells WUSF Susan Giles-Wantuck that the women in her life who cooked were powerful influences, especially her mother.
My mom always tried different recipes. We moved around a lot when I was younger, and so she was influenced by a lot of different cultures, which I know really transferred into my cooking style today. I'm very open to trying different recipes and different flavors. And I think that is important as a child, if you have a chance to try some different things. But my mom was always making us try at least one bite of something. You know, you had to try one bite before you decided you didn't like it.
Is there a recipe that your mom or someone else in your family made that you have to have on the table for holidays?
We weren't really big sweets, but I always remember she would make this sort of a mulled spice pear. And I know it's like very like 70s, 80s kind of thing, but they are beautiful. You skin the pear and then you soak it in either a port wine or something to give it a little bit of that red hue, and then some star anise and, you know, whatever your favorite kind of spices are. And then you poach it, and so it softens it up a little bit. But it looks so beautiful on the plate. It's a half a pear, or you can do a whole one and it just sits right on top, and then you put a little bit of the juice on it. And I think as a kid, it wasn't my favorite flavor-wise, but I always remember how beautiful it looked on the plate. And then so now I can appreciate the flavors of it.
Can you talk a little bit about cocktails for parties that people are having over the holidays?
Absolutely. I love some cocktails. In our house, champagne, I would say, is always the winner. And around the holidays, you can't go wrong by having a couple extra bottles of champagne. If you don't drink, you can use cider or sparkling water with a touch of juice in it. A bottle of champagne is a perfect gift for the holiday season for a hostess. But then at home, if you're a guest stop by, one of my favorite little tricks that we just started doing was making a champagne cocktail. So it's just basically champagne, and then you put a drop of sugar in there, and then put bitters in, and bitters add a little bit of warmth of flavor to it. So it takes regular champagne cocktail and brings it a little bit more into the season. You can use an orange bitters or just a regular bitters. Also, a holiday punch is great. You can make that alcoholic or non-alcoholic, and that's really beautiful, you know, in a really large punch bowl, and, you know, bring back that tradition of scooping out the punch in the little glass. I'm pretty sure you can find one at Salvation Army or or maybe in your grandma's basement. But those look beautiful on the table, and that's something fun that guests can help themselves to as soon as they arrive. And for holiday punches, you know, that great old ring of cranberries frozen in sorbet or something, again, just looks beautiful. You can make a modern twist on that, maybe with some of the larger ice cubes that forms that they have, maybe a, you know, really large ice cube form with some cranberries and maybe some rosemary sprig or something in there. Let that melt in the punch, and that would be beautiful.
Crail, any parting tips you want to leave us with today?
I would say, you know, don't put too much pressure on yourself during the holidays. We live in a Pinterest and social media world where everything's perfect, and people usually celebrate their great wins and their beautiful tables. And as much as I love a beautiful table, the holidays can be just about you and your husband or you and your friends. It doesn't have to be super elaborate. It doesn't have to match your Pinterest board. You know, just really appreciate the small things and don't get too wrapped up in the perfection.
Crail Funch, author, entertaining and lifestyle expert. Her blog is anappealingplan.com. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
There is something so beautiful and unfortunately so rare about a delicious supermarket tomato. Dr. Elizabeth Baldwin is a horticulturist and a leader of the USDA's Agricultural Research Service in Fort Pierce, and she's researching the science of a better tasting tomato. She spoke with Lynn Rosetto Casper, the host of The Splendid Table, for a show that originally aired on that program.
Well, now you took 10 years. You've been researching the tomato. Tell me how this began.
Well, there was a University of Florida breeder by the name of Jay Scott, and he said, I really want to get flavor back into my breeding program, because breeders breed tomatoes for a whole host of horticultural characteristics. I mean, they have to have a plant that is commercially viable, so it has to have good yield and disease resistance, and they do breed for enough sugar. And they breed for size and color, but it's very hard for them to breed for the aroma component, because there's probably 400 aroma volatiles in tomato, of which 20 to 40 probably play a role in the flavor of tomato. And for a breeder to account for all that, they don't have gas chromatographs to measure them. They don't have sensory panels to see how they make the tomato taste. So that's what we do. And so I partnered with this breeder, and we started looking at his advanced lines and selecting them for flavor.
So how do you go about creating a tomato that has all these elements?
Well, in Florida, we have a spring-summer season, which is actually in June, and mm-hmm. fall season that's comes November, December. And then down in South Florida, south of Miami, we can get a March season. So we would harvest his tomato breeding lines in these different seasons. And we would actually cut them up and have a consumer panel taste them. Then I would take the same parts of the tomato and grind them up and do chemical analysis for sugars, acids, and aroma volatiles. And then we would select tomatoes that the sensory panelists thought tasted good, and we would look at the chemical components, and then he would try to breed tomatoes that contained these chemical components. Basically, we wanted to increase the fruity floral notes, because volatiles are like a piano, like notes, like a chord. You put several notes together and you get a chord, but you put volatiles together and you get an aroma profile. And so we wanted to put fruity floral notes, increase those, and decrease slightly the green musty notes that are quite prevalent in supermarket tomatoes now.
Now, you mentioned there are three things that can make or break a tomato.
Yes. First and foremost is the genetics. The genetics, or the breeder's genetic profile, it has the flavor potential for a tomato. Then secondly, there's harvest maturity. Tomatoes are a type of fruit or vegetable that can ripen after you harvest it. Another example is a banana. As opposed to a cherry or a grape, you have to harvest those ripe because they don't continue to ripen after you harvest them. Mm-hmm. Commercially, in Florida, they harvest the tomatoes green, so they're hard and green. They can make it through the transit chain, perhaps up to New York City, and not arrive as mush. So we talk about harvest maturity, and the more you let it stay on the plant, the better it's going to taste. And then after harvest, we call post-harvest storage. The temperature at which they store the tomatoes can affect the flavor. Basically, if you chill the tomatoes, you decrease their aroma.
But you have to chill it in some way, don't you?
You do have to chill it in some way to slow down the ripening. So you harvest the tomato, say, green.
Right.
You chill it to slow down the ripening, and you can ship it farther and have it arrive intact, although it will damage the flavor. Or you can harvest the tomato with a little bit of color on it, red color, pink
right.
color.
Uh-huh.
Then you know that the ripening process has started inside the fruit. If that happens, then the fruit will ripen with better flavor than if the ripening process has not started.
Ah.
And the only way you can tell that is if there's a little red on the tomato peel. So we call those vine ripe.
If you're going to chill a tomato, what temperature is generally used that's still going to maintain the maximum amount of flavor?
If you chill, say, 70 degrees Fahrenheit, you'll probably be okay. But if you go down to 60, which is what the industry generally does, you start to lose flavor. But if you go down to 40 degrees, like refrigerator temperature,
right.
you're definitely going to kill the aroma part of the flavor. And so consumers shouldn't put tomatoes in the refrigerator.
Right, right. You always hear that. So you look for that blush of red.
That's it for today's show. We always like to hear from you. You can tweet us at Florida Matters or send an email to floridamatters@wusf.org. Florida Matters is a production of WUSF Public Media. I'm Robin Sussingham. Thanks for listening.